Gunashtish for being here with us today. You are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Well, you've got to hand it to the Fireside Lecture Series, because last week they took you to the deep waters of Southeast Alaska, and this week they're going to take you to the mountaintops of the Andes, the Alps, and the Himalayas, all over the world to explore climate change and much more. And your guide to this adventure will be Uliana Horodisky. And she is here with us now to give us a preview of tonight's presentation. Actually, she came all the way to Juneau to give this presentation at Mendenhall Glacier in person, but due to the high COVID rates, once again, the lecture has been moved online at a virtual presentation at 7 o'clock tonight. But Uliana, welcome to Juneau, and I bet you're really glad that you're actually here in a way, even though you don't get to give your lecture in person.
Thanks so much. It's really nice to be here. I'm a glaciologist, right? And so having the opportunity to be here in Alaska, to be able to see the Mendenhall Glacier, it's just such a privilege. And thanks very much for hosting me today.
Well, we're excited to hear a little bit about your lecture tonight. But first, can we find out a little bit about you? Currently, you're based out of Colorado. And what are you doing there?
Yeah, so I'm near Denver, Colorado, and I work at the University of Colorado in Boulder. They have a center called the North Central, a Climate Adaptation Science Center. And so I work as an associate scientist there, as well as a communications specialist. My PhD was in glaciology and geology, but I've branched towards climate change just because glaciers are definitely related to that. And I really love educating the public on science. So it kind of led to this career path that has me doing that now, communicating with the public.
And that's so important, because so much of science can appear to be sort of gray and challenging to take in and to embrace. And it takes a special storytelling talent to be able to bring that to life, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, what I like to say is that it's the art of science storytelling, right? The data are really hard sometimes for people to really grasp. What is it showing? What are these graphs? How do we actually interpret or translate this? And that's kind of where I come in and saying, like, what's the relevance of this? How does it relate to our everyday lives? Why should we care about polar bears, for example, or penguins for that matter? But this world is interconnected. And so through my lecture, I hope to show just how interconnected we are as a species and as a planet.
So I'm curious about glaciers. You've visited glaciers all over the world. Maybe you could rattle off a few that you've been to, but what is the advantage of seeing a whole bunch of glaciers?
Yeah, it's basically like the more books you read, the more you learn. So you can think about these glaciers as being books. They're telling us more about the history of a particular region. And so the more you read, the more you learn about different areas, but then you see how they connect also. And so some of the places I've worked in include up in the north, place called Baffin Island in the Canadian Arctic, the one of the biggest ice caps that's left as a result of the last ice age, down in Antarctica in the peninsula region, which is one of the fastest warming places on the planet, the Himalaya, also known as the third pole, just because it has so much ice there that millions of people rely upon. And think of these glaciers as water storage towers. You know, once those run out, we're going to be in trouble. And you can also see them as time capsules. You know, there's a history there that's been recorded, and it's melting away. So we need to be able to gather that information before it's gone.
But cross-referencing all these different glaciers, how does that help? Just to see how one glacier is doing over here in this part of the world and over there in another.
Yeah, so when you think about the north and the southern hemispheres, they are impacted differently. We have the Arctic, which is an ocean surrounded by land, and Antarctica, which is land surrounded by ocean. So the way those glaciers behave is different, yet at the same time, they're all revealing a story of climate change. So the more you can learn about the different responses, you also try to find a commonality there. And that commonality is that where the glaciers are in retreat, they're melting, and they're telling us that things aren't right on the planet. They're not in balance.
Well, I have to ask, your most recent trip took you to the Andes. And for many people who don't know about it, there was a tremendous plane crash there 50 years ago in which there were, 45 people on board, 16 survived after two harrowing months. And of course, I guess people know this story because there was some cannibalism involved for the 16 people to make it out of the glacier. But they were stranded for 2 months before they found help. So it's quite a story. So you were up there at the crash site. What were you looking for, and how much had it changed?
Yeah, so the backstory of that is my husband Ricardo is a mountaineer. He's fascinated by the story. And back in 2005, he actually went to the site and climbed up a gully where the impact point presumably was. And he found a bunch more of the plane parts up there, as well as something buried in the rocks. And it was a coat. And when he opened up the coat, there was actually still a passport and a wallet in there. And it was actually from one of the survivors. So he reached out to the survivor, and it started this long friendship now where they go every year and take people actually to the site, because it's just such a story of perseverance and resilience. It's just an incredibly moving story. And so we were just there for the 50th anniversary, and it's stunning. The last time we were there was 2020, right before the pandemic hit. And just seeing in 2 years how much the glacier has melted. I mean, there's artifacts melting out of the glacier that were there for 50 years, you know, covered up. And now it's just, it's a place that's quite remote. It takes 4x4 vehicles, it takes horseback and then on foot to get there. And it's right on the border with Chile. And so most people wouldn't go there if it wasn't for the story and what happened there. So these glaciers aren't being studied. So it's also an opportunity to document, you know, what is changing in one of these remote places, meaning that climate change touches every part of the planet, not just the ones that are nearby urban, you know, cities.
That is an amazing story. Just being there on scene, seeing the debris from the wreckage and the clothing, things like that. What went through your mind?
It really brings the story to life. You know, you read a story, you read Alive, that's the name of the book, and I've seen the movie. And I was sitting on the spot where the fuselage, the part of the plane, came to rest, where the survivors lived out the 72 days. And I was reading pages of the book right there on the same spot. And I was looking out east where what they were seeing. And I was looking west and thinking, how in the world do we climb this peak? And it was just an absolutely surreal experience to be like, how did they manage to really survive all this? What it took mentally and physically. And then just seeing the evidence melting out of the glacier, you know, there's seats, tray tables, armrests, and to think someone was sitting in that, you know, it's such a tragedy, but also a story of resilience.
Well, I suppose that we're going to be seeing more things emerge out of long frozen glaciers from the past in coming years. And some of it might be very interesting to discover: Neanderthal bones, old artifacts that might give us more understanding of the past. But in a way, it is sort of unnerving to think that things are emerging this quickly.
Right. That's the thing. Like, we knew this was going to happen, but we're thinking about it decades down the road, right? To see something like this happening again, like just in 2 years' time, seeing these big cracks, the crevasses opening up in a glacier and meltwater channels and waterfalls forming from all the melting ice was just stunning. And it really highlights that we are running out of time, you know, to do something about it. Yet it's not a hopeless situation. There's a lot we can and should be doing.
So one of the things in your research is you've documented how something that happens weather-wise or disaster-wise in one part of the world affects another part of the world way, way, way far away.
Yeah, so when you think about just the winds, for example, winds can carry stuff a long way. So thinking about, for example, a forest fire, right? A forest fire somewhere in Western Canada or even here in Alaska, the winds can carry that soot, you know, that residue from that wildfire all the way over to parts of Europe and Asia, right? Because it's in a matter of just a couple of weeks. And then when that soot settles out on that snow and ice up there, in fact, that those dark particles can absorb more of the sun's energy and melt that snow faster. So it's not just a problem with rising temperatures. It's also this pollution problem. Now, wildfires aren't pollution coming from people, right? But wildfires are a result of things drying up and drought and causing more fires than otherwise would be happening.
So you found evidence of this in Norway, right? Of an American forest fire impacting glacial melting all the way in Norway.
Yeah. So, and how you can do that is knowing you can use these computer models that tell you where the winds came from. So first the direction, and then look at the timing of when you were there. And just even collecting samples of snow and ice from the surface can reveal it. Or you dig down a little bit deeper, and you can find it. And not only that, but now they're even finding microplastics way up north. So that's, again, evidence of us having an impact that's reaching much further than we expected.
So one of the things that you do is you combine science and mountaineering. That is an interesting combination. How does it help your research?
Yeah, so I was always restless as a kid. You know, I was always doing sports camps, and I was playing soccer and running track. But I loved science, too. And I was kind of torn because as a kid, I'm like, I want to do science fairs, but I want to be on a sports team. But that doesn't really mesh well. You don't have enough time to do it. And so as I grew older and went to college and thinking about career-wise, what I want to do, I'm like, maybe there's a way I can blend these things. And maybe I can go and collect samples and scientific observations where people who don't have the scientific training but who climb won't know to do. So that kind of got me thinking about, well, maybe I should train more seriously as a mountaineer, really learn the skills to be able to do science in those far corners of the planet. And then the high, I like to call it high latitudes and high altitudes.
Well, one of the things that you have done here in Alaska, which is kind of exciting, and we just had a segment on this on Juno Afternoon not too long ago, is the Inspiring Girls Expeditions, because they're trying to recruit more girls. And you led an expedition for the Girls on Ice group. And what was that all about? And what did you share with the girls?
Yeah, so that was a great opportunity. So I was able to do this in Mount Baker in Washington State, as well as the Golconda Glacier in Alaska. And that was actually my first time to Alaska back in 2015. And it was a great way to get young girls who may be interested but intimidated, you know, by science or by mountaineering. And then throwing them into the wild and doing both at the same time was such a challenge for them. But watching them over the course of that week, like learn about what it takes to actually do science in the wild and have them also blossom and learn about how they can actually overcome a lot of challenges. I mean, you can imagine bad weather that we had or rain coming down, hail, everything that they faced and carrying heavy packs. It was just a really cool thing to be a part of because, you know, thinking about how I got my start, you know, I was very fortunate. I had parents who really wanted me to do a lot of experiential learning, going on field trips, going out into summer camps. And the beautiful thing about the Inspiring Girls Expeditions is that they fund it. And so girls who might not have a chance to be able to fund something like this get the opportunity to experience it.
Well, I have to ask you this, because for things like mountaineering and the expeditions that you've been on in the Himalayas, the Alps, Kilimanjaro, I mean, these aren't easy places to get to. They're very physically demanding. Do you feel that women might face a little bit of discrimination because men might be viewed as stronger and more able to weather the conditions?
That's certainly been the case in the past. And I can tell you a story from when I was a kid competing in a science fair at 14 years old. And I was waiting to hear the results of the contest in the back with all these guys who are like 17 and 18 years old. And here I am. It's like, everyone's really tall. And then there's this short little girl. And somebody comes up to me. I was like, are you lost? And I ended up winning my category. So there's definitely this expectation that you don't belong. And in mountaineering, something similar, right? Like, how can you carry heavy packs? How can you do this? But I think that's definitely changing over the years that I've seen. I'm happy to say that. But definitely, I feel like you have to work twice as hard to get half the recognition.
Boy, twice as hard to get half the recognition. But boy, I tell you, I think people will be impressed when they see your presentation tonight. And unfortunately, it has been moved online. But you can go to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center's Facebook page. It's live. It starts at 7. People can ask you questions. So it's not totally like watching a video or something. It sounds like it'll be fun. And you'll probably have lots of great pictures, right?
Yeah, lots of great pictures. Looking forward to the questions. We want to make it very interactive. One thing I wanted to say is a big thank you to the U.S. Forest Service for setting that up, and Eagle Raven Global as well, a local company here, for sponsoring my visit out here.
Well, I hope that your excursions out to our glaciers make you want to come back here, and we have another chance to talk with you more. Thank you so much. Uliana Horodisky, a good Ukrainian name, right?
Yes, you got it perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.